Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined as always by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the future of the Electoral College. And Richard, we're at a high tide right now for criticisms of the Electoral College. And it's, I guess, easy enough to understand why. In the vast majority of presidential elections throughout American history, the winner of the popular vote and the winner of the Electoral College have been one and the same. But in two of our last five elections, that hasn't been the case. The only really comparable period in American history is in the late 19th century, where you had two elections go to the loser of the popular vote in the span of 12 years. But even that's not an exact analogy, because that includes 1876, which was actually kind of settled by this ad hoc committee and was tangled up in all the complications of Reconstruction. So that's the history. Let's go even further back. Let's start with how we got here. The Electoral College has changed a good bit since its inception. So take us back to the founding fathers. What were their reasons for building a system like this, for something called the Electoral College?
Well, I think the first thing you have to do is to start with the sort of political economy of the time. And this was something which had three pairs derived from Aristotle. Pair number one is that you could have monarchy or you could have despotism and tyranny. Tier number two was that you could have aristocracy on the one hand, or you could have oligarchy on the other. And tier number three was that you could have a republican form of government, or you could have democracy on the other. And the whole point in the original theory is that the first one in each of these three pairings was regarded as virtuous, so that the enlightened monarch was somebody who cared about and acted as a fiduciary and as a trustee with respect to his subjects, whereas the tyrant just simply taxed them or extorted from them in any way, shape that he could. And then with respect to the aristocracies, these were noble people who, again, had a sense of benevolence and awareness. The oligarchy is a tight group which essentially tries to milk everything out of society and doesn't care about the little people. And the last of these pairs, republican, the word republican comes out of the Roman tradition, res publicae, things having to concern with the public. And this is a broad-based situation, but it understands implicitly that it can only deal with matters that are public. It has no role to play with respect to ordinary kind of private affairs, and that when it starts to deal with these matters, it's well aware of the dangers of democracy, which at that time was thought to be a crude synonym for mob rule, and so that what you had to do was to put into place a series of institutions which made sure that simple majoritarianism would not be able to select of government. The great fear at the time was you elect the popular majority, and what it can do is can enact legislation, regulation, taxation, and so forth, which could wipe out the minority in its own midst and enrich the majority. And the mob rule was thought to be that way. So when you hear people like James Madison talking about it, he was worried about the huge population of debtors passing debtor relief legislation so as to release their debts to the rich bankers who happened to hold them on the other side. And there are many passages in the Federalist Papers in which he really does tee off against these folks. Madison, like Lincoln, like Washington, like Jefferson, are kind of sanitized today and are thought to be much more democratic than they really were. They were all, to some extent, kinds of elitists. Well, if you don't believe in having a single person or a very small group running the show, and you want to have a larger group running the show, then you have to have very complicated institutional designs to see how it is that you're going to have more voices at the table without allowing anybody to have this particular power. And so in the American system, we introduced all sorts of ways to deal with this. We, first of all, at the federal level, we have a system of enumerated powers, so you can't run roughshod over everybody by going into business that you don't belong to. And the Republican spirit of the things that are public was very consistent with that. The federal government was really designed to deal with things like public finance, public taxation, commerce across state lines, and was not supposed to deal with any kind of localized matters having to do with mining, with manufacture, with agriculture, and the like. And then you had a very complicated system in which you had a president, then you had a Congress with two houses with different rules, and then you had a judiciary which had some checking function in individual cases. And if you start to look both of these institutions, that is the legislative were designed essentially along non-majoritarian principles. And the Congress, the Senate, was originally subject not to direct election. That only came, I guess it was with the 16th or 17th Amendment, I never keep the numbers straight, sort of taking place just before the First World War. But the senators were chosen by the state legislatures, and they were chosen in order to give the states an extra control over what the federal government can do. It was a corrupt system, but popular elections essentially removed state power over the central government and paved the way for more extensive regulation and taxes, which took place exactly at that particular point in time. And then there was the question about the House, and they couldn't quite figure out what to do with the House. And this was a problem of, is there a uniform standard as to who has the franchise? Because everybody understood that the franchise was the key to power, and there were very different rules in the different states. And what they did is they settled on a very ingenious compromise, which says that the House of Representatives is chosen by the rule that each particular state has in order to choose its most populous branch of government. So essentially, they didn't force themselves into a common solution. But what they did is they said, we have a relatively elite set of voting rules on for one part of the government, the Senate, and a more generous for the other part. We'll pick the more generous part, which did not mean universal franchise. This was very similar to the British system. And if you remember, Troy, in 1832, you had this huge crisis with the British Reform Act in an effort to get rid of the rotten boroughs and to try to open a parliament to more generous principles. When you got to the president, it was the same game. Nobody trusted a popular election of the president. And so what they did is they went back to a lot of medieval practices, particularly with juries, in which one jury of eight would choose another jury of 20, which would then choose a jury of six, which would decide the case. And the theory was, if you have these different layers in here, it would make it very different for the people directly to control this situation. So what we did is we had an electoral college. Remember, its composition is skewed because you give one electoral vote for each senator and one for each House member of the House of Representatives. This was an effort to strengthen the position of the smaller states because they had the Senate. This was deliberately designed to be anti-majoritarian. And then you had a college. When they chose their delegates, they were supposed to heaven's sake deliberate and try to figure out, because the obvious analogy was that the college to choose the president, the electoral college, was sort of like the College of Cardinals trying to choose the Pope. And that's the way in which they started, and you know what? It broke down.
Okay, so taking it to today, the current debate runs something like this. The critics of the Electoral College say, as hinted at by what you just said there, this is fundamentally undemocratic. It gives disproportionate power to these small rural states. I mean, the number of times that Wyoming is invoked in these conversations is overwhelming. And the defenders of it say, well, that's precisely the point. If you do away with this system, you are going to be conveying extraordinary privileges on big population centers, and that's going to come at the expense of the rest of the country. How do you navigate that argument, Richard?
Well, I mean, there's a step in the middle, which is that the deliberative system failed, right? And so what they then did is they basically bound the electors, because they realized you can't deliberate if you're representing a bunch of people who can't review what you're doing. And the cardinals only represent themselves. So it was a fatal analogy. So then what you do is you have the pledged electors, and it was a winner-take-all system across the state line. And this was also consistent with the general view, which is you didn't want to have any fragmented or divided situation, because it was, and I think this is an important insight, as important to get a clear winner as it is to get a winner who somehow or other represents the popular will. You'd rather have 49 beat 51 than have a huge battle and all sorts of discussions and recounts and everything else in order to get 51 to do 49. And so I that. Now, in the United States today, however, the ratios have really started to change. And so what happens is you have the problem of the wasted vote built into the Electoral College system. You have states like New York and California, which have huge Democratic majorities. And what happens is nobody bothers to campaign in any of these states. 51 votes in one place and 27 or whatever it is in the other state. They sort of go right to the Democratic line. The Republicans have comparable advantages, but less dramatically. Texas is probably the leading illustration. Florida is a state which has gotten quite large, usually Republican. By no means is it fixed in that situation. So the Democrats are screaming that they've got all of these wasted votes, and the system, therefore, does not accommodate the popular sentiment. And there's no question that at a certain point, they're right. Now, you can't necessarily infer this from the popular vote, because if you're running an electoral college system, the strategies are very different. Any state where you've automatically won, you don't try to get another vote. If you've automatically lost, what difference does it make by how much? So essentially, 90% of the money is going to be concentrated in 10 or 12 swing states, which together are sufficient to switch the thing from one side to the other. And we all know which these purple states turn out to be, places like Colorado, New Mexico, and so forth, and maybe Illinois or Michigan and Wisconsin. They're kind of states which, you know, they can go either way. They have tendencies. Doesn't very much matter. And so the reason why Donald Trump was smart and Hillary Clinton was not smart is that he made all the right moves where to put his final dollars in the week before the Tuesday election, and he put it in all the swing states where it was closed. Whereas Hillary, who thought she was going to win, wanted to run up the popular mandate, popular vote to get a mandate, and she made colossal blunders. She took people out of Pennsylvania, which eventually went to Trump, and then she invested in North Carolina, where she lost by 6 or 7 points. She did the same thing in Arizona and lost again. She ran up the popular vote in California, and so she got an impressive majority in the popular vote, but she managed to lose the presidential election. You changed the electoral system. So it's a force-past-the-post system by simple majority rule. There will never be a Democrat who will leave the Democratic havens, and there'll never be a Republican who will read their stronghold. Now, instead of winning swing states, they don't even matter. They aren't such a thing anymore. Everybody's going to try to put the turnout in their home base as high as they possibly can. And they're going to have friendly guys sitting at the voting booths, and you're going to have massive fraud and national recounts in order to make the system work. It's something that I find generally frightening. I mean, I kind of like the notion of a popular vote winning, but I certainly don't like it at the extent of having massive uncertainties and real claims of vote fraud. You just recall what happened in Florida and how difficult that election was in 2000. You might want to go back and remember what happened in Illinois in 1960 when Mr. Daley delivered the state to Mr. Kennedy by rather dubious means. And then there was landslide Lyndon and all the stuff that he did in 1948 to get himself elected and so forth. That's going to happen. We cannot run a nationwide recount. It is simply impossible to do so. So if we have 120 million voters or 130 million voters and a majority of 500,000, you'll never get it right. I'm so afraid of that, that to me everything else really does not matter. And there will be huge grievances on both sides, at least with Bush v. Gore, when you had all of that stuff, you got a reasonably clean outcome before January 20th. Remember, the court got these cases on December 2nd, and it decided them on December 4th. I mean, they really pushed the whole envelope. I thought some of the rulings were simply extraordinary. I thought Bush v. Gore was crazy on equal protection. I thought it was right on the fact that the states get control over how they choose their electors, a provision which did not get a lot of attention there. I thought the decisions in Florida, in which they took the power out of the hands of the Secretary of State in whom it was vested and put it into a recount commission, were completely wrong. But you knew exactly what was going on. Why should this crazy lady who happens to be Secretary of the State be the most powerful person in the United States when it comes to running the recounts? So you cannot imagine how things are going to be seismic when it works up, because one of the things we know is, in case you haven't noticed, Troy, there's a little bit of a gap between Donald Trump, the probable Republican nominee, and the group of five from whom you'll probably pick the next Democratic guy. I think maybe I'm wrong. I think there are only five candidates who actually left in the race at this particular point. Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, and Kamala Harris. Does that strike you as right?
That seems to be the way that's going. It'll probably be one of those five. Let me ask you as we wrap up here, Richard.
Yeah, sure.
There are 48 states currently that operate in the Electoral College under winner-take-all rules. So basically, yeah, whoever wins the most in the popular vote, they get all of the electoral votes for that state. We should note there are two exceptions, which are Maine and Nebraska. So Maine has two House seats. Nebraska has three. And the system they use in those states is that whoever wins statewide gets the two electoral votes that correspond to the Senate seats, but then the ones that correspond to the House seats are actually given out on the basis of who wins in each of those congressional districts. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, you can have a situation – this happened in 2016 where Hillary Clinton won statewide in Maine and won in one of its congressional districts, so she got three, but Donald Trump won the other district and so got one. And some people have suggested that a broader adoption of a principle like this may quell some of the anxiety around the Electoral College without getting into the territory of total abolition. What's your view on that?
I think that there is a perfectly sensible way to do that, because it's all by counting. And in effect, what happens is, if it turns out that you have differential preferences in the state, the minority voices are more likely to be heard. So I have no particular objection to that, because you can do it by counting. What I do have objections to has been another proposal that has been made, which you didn't mention, which is somebody says, what we do is we instruct the electors in our state that they will be bound to vote for a certain candidate after they get a certain amount of electoral votes somewhere else. And so what they're going to basically force them to do is to switch political loyalty. I don't think that it's constitutional. I think, in effect, what happens is, once you appoint your electors, they're going to go out there. You mentioned to me before the show that there was the rogue elector in 2016 who decided that he was not going to vote for Hillary Clinton. Voted for John Kasich, I think it was. And recently, I think there was a judicial decision which says that they couldn't hold him back. I think that's probably right. I'm perfectly prepared to allow there to be a convention which says that you are bound to vote for the party who selected you, but I don't think it ought to be enforceable in a way that you could force them to change their votes by what it is that the legislature wants to do. That is to pre-program. I think you have to take the risk of disloyalty. I think for the most part, it's just not going to happen, because when people choose their slates, except under extreme circumstances, they're going to choose people who are known to be reliable in both directions. And I think each party is frightened to the death if they encourage that in the other party, that turnabout will be fair play. So I don't think that that's going to do it, and I think this scheme will start to fail. I can see doing something like that, and it doesn't bother me, because if anything, now your recounts are going to be in smaller congressional districts, right? They're not going to be in statewide situation. So everything considered, yeah, that's a possibility, and it's perfectly consistent with the constitutional structure. If it works well in Nebraska and Maine, and larger states want to try it, so be it. It will change the calculus, by the way, on how you campaign. I mean, it's going to be very difficult to figure out what to do when you start to figure out, well, where do you spend your money in Texas, right? And it turns out there are four or six congressional districts that are really up in the air, and the others are perfectly clear. Do you really want to spend the same kind of money that you would if the entire state were at issue on an all-or-nothing vote? The strategies will change, but I think that's within the realm of the possible. Maybe it's not within the realm of the desirable.
Let me, I'm going to sneak in one more for you just briefly, sure, because it occurs to me that we haven't actually mentioned the sort of the big proposal coming from Democrats, which is just scrap it altogether. Several of the Democrats running for president have called for getting rid of it. Pete Buttigieg has probably been the most direct in calling for a constitutional amendment to jettison it, which is obviously the most straightforward traditional approach. But it also, Richard, sort of has the air of fantasy around it. I mean, because we are living through one of these periods in American history. The era between Jefferson and the Civil War was like this. To a lesser extent, so was the time between Reconstruction and the Progressive Era, where constitutional amendments just don't happen anymore. And it's hard to see them reemerging anytime soon, because you've got a super majoritarian tool, and we're sufficiently polarized that we don't have super majorities for anything in American life these days. Is it a good thing or a bad thing that the amendment process is essentially on the shelf right now?
I'm not pleased, but I am relieved, I think, is the way I would put it. I basically want all sorts of constitutional amendments which would return us to the kind of constitution that we had pre-1937, limited enumerated federal powers, stronger property and contract rights and so forth, less of everything done at the federal government. You start having a convention and it's going to run everything in the opposite direction. It will be dominated by progressives or by certain conservatives who do not have market principles but social principles that I may not agree with. So I am absolutely petrified at the thought of any convention, any runaway convention with future amendments by various parties going through. I will take my chances on the Supreme Court in terms of interpretation. The obvious point is what you saw happen with respect to Kavanaugh and Gorsuch will happen again and again. And sure enough, There will be proposals to rig that institution, the most common one being now to quote-unquote expand or pack the court by putting in seven other people. I saw a harebrained proposal that came in the email to me today saying, nope, what we really want to do is to have more seats, shorter terms, and we get the president to appoint one, and then the leader of the opposition party in the Senate gets to nominate the next person. There are going to be a lot of proposals like this. I think we're better off just sticking with the system that we have. And we talk about constitutional conventions, remember, and comedy. We mentioned this on our recent show about Brexit. These rules are breaking down. There is nothing in the United States Constitution which says that you have only 9 Supreme Court justices. There's only something which says you have 1 Supreme Court, which is very different. So you could pack it, but I think the current equilibrium has to be preserved at all costs. Otherwise, what will happen is you will have endless amounts of strategic behavior. You'll put it up to 15, then there'll be somebody who dies, and the opposition will simply say, we'll go with 14. We don't want to let anybody go through. And by the time you're done, you will politicize the judiciary in a way that everybody will come to regret.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter. That's at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting DefiningIdeas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.